The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 063099, United States of America versus Reedy Van Smith, appellant. Ms. Davis for the appellant, Ms. Chisholm for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Mary Davis. I represent the appellant, Reedy Van Smith. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal. There's a single issue on appeal, and that is whether the trial court erred when it did not dismiss the indictment due to violation of the Speedy Trial Act. Within this single issue are four sub-issues. The first is whether the filing of a Rule 609 notice by the government tolls the speedy trial clock. The second issue is whether the filing of a Rule 404B notice tolls the speedy trial clock. The third is whether the clock is automatically reset when a co-defendant is joined in via a superseding indictment. And the fourth is whether the Supreme Court's ruling in Henderson forecloses any consideration of the length of time a district court takes to decide and hear pretrial motions, or do local speedy trial plans establish certain enforceable rights for a defendant. In regard to the Rule 609 notice, we would submit that the appellant was indicted on June 9, 2004, and the government filed the Rule 609 notice on July 27, 2004. There was absolutely nothing filed by the defendant in opposition to this notice. We would submit that this issue has been decided by the case of United States v. Harris, when the court held that Rule 609 notice is not a pretrial motion for purposes of the Speedy Trial Act. It is only when the defendant files an opposition to that notice does the clock stop. This makes sense because if you look at Rule 12b3c, it talks about pretrial motions. In this case, it was just an offer of evidence by the government. And we can't really say that the defendant's opposition to the 609 notice at trial would cause the Speedy Trial Act to be tolled, because the defense opposition to the notice didn't occur until halfway through trial. So therefore, we think that this issue is decided by this circuit's opinion and U.S. v. Harris, and that the 609 notice did not toll the speedy trial clock. We think that the same reasoning applies to the motion in limine filed by the government, I believe, in January of 2005, that the 404B notice, again, is just a notice of offer of evidence, and is not a pretrial motion. Again, there was nothing filed by the defendant opposing the 404B evidence. In fact, there is nothing in the record to indicate that there was any argument on the 404B evidence, or that the trial court even decided the 404B issue. It was just merely offered and in evidence at trial, and there was no opposition to it. So therefore, we think that the 404B issue, the same reasoning applies as in the Harris case, and that this did not toll the speedy trial clock. The third sub-issue is whether the joinder of Cassandra Trent tolled the clock, and we would submit that that looking at the statute that is applicable, you can only stop the speedy trial clock for periods that are reasonable. In this case, the time from when Ms. Trent was brought into the case until the case actually went to trial was well over a year. I would also note that Ms. Trent filed a motion for severance on February 28th of 2005. The government filed an opposition to that on March 18th, 2005. However, there's no ruling on the severance motion until January 20th, 2006, almost 1 year later. Again, under the Speedy Trial Act, this ruling, there should have been a ruling on the severance within 30 days of when all the papers were filed before the court. I think in this case, it is clear that severance was granted, and so therefore, it is not fair to Mr. Smith for the time that he has spent incarcerated and to not count towards his speedy trial clock merely because the trial judge didn't decide motions in a timely manner. I think a lot of this boils down to what is whether this court, in light of the Supreme Court's opinion in Henderson, whether this court can consider what is reasonable or what is not reasonable, and whether the local rules have any bearing on what a trial judge should do in deciding these motions in a timely manner. In this case, it was a very simple case. I believe the entire trial lasted 2 or 3 days. The motions were simple motions. They were just motions to suppress evidence, and I believe Ms. Trent filed a motion to suppress statements. There is no reason that this case should have taken over a year from when motions were filed until they were decided, and almost 2 years from when Mr. Smith was arrested until he finally made it to trial. I think the local rules require that trial judges do certain things at certain points in time, and that was not done in this case. A trial date is supposed to be set within, 3 weeks of arraignment. The judge didn't set a trial date until almost a year later. And I was just given a transcript that the government received over the weekend. And the trial judge in this case advised counsel early on in the case that he would not be able to try the case for well over a year because he would be tied up in a multi-defendant 12-week trial.
What's the date of that transcript?
The date of the transcript is October 6, 2004.
And your client filed his first motion for a speedy trial in July of 2005?
I don't have that on. I believe it may have been before that, Your Honor. But
a motion to set bond.
And that was right after he was arrested in 2004, correct?
Notes show, and I just want to be clear if you agree, that he filed the motion to dismiss on the grounds of speedy trial July 21st, 2005.
That may be. Your Honor, I would point out in this October 6th transcript, which I just received, the parties at that time raised orally speedy trial concerns. And it was at that time that the trial judge notified the parties that he would not be able to try this case for over a year, I believe he said. Again, I just had a couple of minutes to review this. So I think under the local plans, the judge should have made some effort to get the case reassigned to another judge that could hear it. It was not a lengthy trial, and I believe that would have been the proper course to follow in this case. And unless the court has additional questions, I will reserve my remaining time.
Good morning. May it please the court, Sarah Chasson on behalf of the United States. In Harris, this court has held that a motion to preclude impeachment under Rule 609 was a motion for purposes of stopping the Speedy Trial Act clock. The same reasoning compels the conclusion that the government's affirmative motion to admit to seek the court's permission to impeach the defendant with his prior convictions under Rule 609 is likewise a motion stopping the Speedy Trial Act clock.
Why? How can you distinguish Harris?
Because in Harris, Your Honor, the government initially filed a document called a notice, which this court held was not sufficient to stop the Speedy Trial Act clock.
So even though the rules talk about notice, we should treat this as a motion?
Well, the government filed a motion. And
it called it a motion, but it was a notice under the rules.
It was a little more than a notice, Your Honor.
What
it was
did it do that other than tell the defendant?
It set forth the precise convictions that the government believed would be appropriate to use in the event of impeachment.
Right.
Set forth why those met the criteria under Rule 609 and requested a hearing at which those might be addressed. The reason why that's actually a motion, it's not automatic under Rule 609 that one gets to impeach the defendant. Rule 609 contemplates a role for the district court. Rule 609 expressly says that the convictions not only have to fall within certain time parameters.
You're saying our opinion in Harris was incorrect?
I am saying that the opinion in Harris was correct based upon if the government filed a notice, and I don't know what the document looked like or what it requested
so
there.
Two proceedings involve the same rule.
it all depends how the government labels something?
No. It is not simply the question of the caption. It is this. The question is whether the government is seeking the court's permission to do something. And in Harris, this court appeared to hold that what the government filed was nothing more than an offer of proof, if you will, an offer setting forth that these are the convictions. Here, the government actually requested the court's leave, and we, in fact, had argument at trial over whether it was appropriate to impeach the defendant with those convictions.
So how does this reconcile with the Speedy Trial Act?
Well, the Speedy Trial Act provides that any pretrial motion is going to stop the Speedy Trial Act clock
right.
until it is
so
resolved.
So on admission of evidence, it's not, as happened here, the district court didn't rule on any of these things until the trial started. So that means as soon as you file something that you label a notice, you label a motion, that stops the Speedy Trial Act?
It is not enough to simply...
ad infinitum?
It is not simply enough to label it a motion, Your Honor. The government not only presented convictions, which were highly prejudicial given the...
Yeah, but there wasn't any motion to exclude.
There was the
Doesn't the government have the right to introduce such evidence in the absence of any opposition?
Well, the government is always at the mercy of the district court in terms of its determination of relevance versus the substantially prejudicial impact of it. Which
is. Do you understand my question about how does this fit in with the Speedy Trial Act? In other words, the government under the rules is required to give notice to a defendant of certain things. By
yes.
labeling it a motion, it stops the Speedy Trial Act. And 25 years later, we finally get to trial.
Well, I don't think that anybody thought that when that motion was filed, it would take several years to reach the trial date.
Why
I think
did the government label it a motion?
Because they needed the court's permission in order to proceed with the impeachment, was the government's view.
We're going in circles.
What?
Sure.
Well.
What if the defendant never takes the stand?
If the defendant never takes.
The court reserves judgment. 609 issue. You go to trial and the defendant doesn't take the stand.
It would still be
period,
the
still a stopping the running of the 70-day period?
Yes. There is nothing in either the Speedy Trial Act or in Henderson that precludes a finding that any motion, even if it's a contingent motion as it were, does not have the effect of stopping the Speedy Trial Act clock. There are a number of instances where one could imagine that other contingent events that would be appropriately the subject of pretrial motions would likewise stop the Speedy Trial Act clock. Like, for example, turning to the 404B motion, it is very easy to envision a district court saying that it needs to see how the government's case is coming in order to evaluate whether the prejudicial impact of that evidence would outweigh its probative value.
Indicate, however, that the only reason 404B includes that notice requirement is for the same reason as 609.
There's still
a notice requirement. It's not a motion where the government seeks to get the district court of it essentially to approve its entire evidentiary proffer prior to the start of the trial.
Well, the district court frequently does prevent the government from introducing Rule 404B notice or conducting impeachment under Rule 609.
If the defendant objects.
Yeah.
If the defendant objects. But it would be manifestly unfair, I think, to deem as conceded and perhaps even, perhaps pose collateral litigation consequences to simply deem conceded an impeachment of the prior convictions mentioned in the Rule 609 notice here. These were serious matters. And typically...
From the district court's perspective, all these motions are filed. And who knows what's going to happen between the time the motions are filed and the time the district court finally has a calendar date for the trial. And essentially, the Speedy Trial Act disappears.
The Speedy Trial Act... Does not essentially disappear. The Speedy Trial Act.
From the point of view of the district court, it's more judicially efficient to deal with these motions when about to get to trial. Who knows? Just as in this case, the government decided it was going to have a superseding indictment. Defendants may plead out there may be no need for the district court to spend time and energy on motions.
But that doesn't nonetheless change the status of the motion. For example,
If indeed it's a motion.
But for example, a motion to sever, I don't think there was very much disagreement about whether that would operate to stop the Speedy Trial Act clock.
The rules contemplate that 609 and 404B are simply notices. They're not motions absent some opposition by the defendant. And the government wants us to basically reject that view that this court has previously adopted of the rules in order to avoid the problem of delay here.
But we had opposition by the defendant. I mean, when it came time for his client to take the stand, he objected. He said these are.
He wanted to retroactively validate the situation.
No, I'm asking the court to adopt the position that the Speedy Trial Act says any pretrial motion stops the speedy trial clock and does not discriminate as to whether that motion is contingent.
Any pretrial motion under the rules, correct?
Yes.
All right.
We don't have to reach this issue, do we?
No. The court.
Have to reach 404B?
The court would have to reach the issue on the 404B, provided that. There are a couple of different scenarios. The 404B issue would have to be resolved.
But yes. Not the Rule 609.
But not the Rule 609.
Because it's 70 days, because by your calculation, from the time that Trent was joined, plus the period, the 30-day period for the 404B motion pending. Right?
Yes. There is no Speedy Trial Act violation if the 404B notice likewise stops the Speedy Trial Act clock or this 404B motion. I will then turn to the government's alternative position, which is that the superseding indictment with the joinder of Ms. Trent likewise reset the Speedy Trial Act clock and started it again. That was precisely the circumstances that occurred in Henderson, where a defendant who was severed on the day of trial, there was also the last joined defendant, and that co-defendant's Speedy Trial Act time governed the proceedings from there on out. So it is the government's view that under Henderson and the other cases that we've cited, King and Lightfoot and Barnes as well from the First Circuit, that the clock ought to have correctly been reset with the joinder of Ms. Trent to the case. Turning briefly in my last 20 seconds to the question of the local rules establishing a substantive remedy under the Speedy Trial Act, I would note that the local Speedy Trial Act plan itself says that dismissal for noncompliance with its provisions is not a remedy and expressly incorporates the analysis set forth in the Speedy Trial Act to determine if there has been a violation. And in view of the government's position that there is no violation under the Speedy Trial Act, the local rules would have no effect.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
In brief response, I think I would ask the court's permission to file this with the court, the status hearing from October 6, 2004. It is very relevant in regard to the 609 issue because it was argued by Mr. Grimm, the co-defendant's attorney, that the government routinely files 609 notices simply to toll the speedy trial clock. And at that time, both defendants conceded 609. And that the evidence was admissible. So even though it may have been re-argued halfway through trial by Mr. Smith's attorney, it was conceded at that time. There was no opposition to the 609. Again, there was no opposition, nothing filed, no argument, even at trial regarding the 404B. So again, the 404B is simply a notice that evidence will be introduced, and it was introduced without any objection whatsoever. Based on these, we feel that the Speedy Trial Act was violated. The judge should have dismissed the case for violation of the act.
Thank you, Ms. Davison. You were appointed by the court, and we appreciate your representation. Thank you.